Well, this morning, award-winning writer and poet Jonathan Drane will be speaking at Port Macquarie Library at 10 o'clock, so that's in about 45 minutes' time. Jonathan has already published an autobiographical work called The Way of a Thousand Arrows, and he's mainly going to be talking about that book this morning, but he's also going to talk a bit about another work that he's currently completing, a historical novel based on the Camden Haven pilot station in Dunbogan, where he's holidayed for many years with his family. It's called The First Pilot. And why don't I ask him, rather than me telling you what it's about. Jonathan Drane, good morning to you. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Michael, and thank you for inviting me in today.
Happy to. Always love talking writing and authors. Now let's start with the main subject this morning at Port Macquarie Library is this book called The Way of a Thousand Arrows.
Yes, that's right.
It's an amazing story because essentially you and your wife said to the family of three, two girls and a boy, we're going to take a journey of about 450 kilometres, and we're going to walk. And this is not in Australia, this was in Santiago.
Yep.
Tell me how this came about. What was the genesis for this sort of trip?
Well, what was interesting with it was it actually coincided with the death of my mother in the same year. And interestingly, my mother had been what I would call a closet spiritualist and had introduced me to Shirley MacLaine when I was a kid, and I'd forgotten about all that. When she died, that all came out again. And that year, Shirley MacLaine published her book on the Camino. And so I said, let's go. I think I'm being called. And so I called to the family, let's try this adventure across Spain, you know. So
okay, so you mentioned, let me just clarify, mentioned the book's called An Australian Family's Journey Through the Camino de Santiago. And where exactly is that?
Okay, so the Camino de Santiago is the Spanish Pilgrim Trail, is, I guess, the more common name, and it runs across the top of Spain, but it starts in France on the other side of the Pyrenees, and that's in a place called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port. And it's a 1,000-kilometre journey then across the top of Spain right to Finisterre, which is the end of the earth in the old language of what Finisterre means, which is where Columbus headed off and proved that wasn't the end of the earth. So
did anyone in the family make the absurd suggestion that how about you get a car and drive?
No, they weren't that bad, but within the first day, we had our youngest sort of had blisters and was distraught at the idea of walking. I think it thought it was a bit of a novelty, but after about 10 to 15 kilometres was basically about to pack it in, and we had 450 kilometres to go. Or in fact, we thought probably about 600 at that time. So, yeah, so that was the first grumble. She was 14.
Surely not. Surely the first grumble was when you broached the idea to the family in Australia.
Well, the wonderful thing about, I guess, teenagers is it sounded mystical and sort of exotic, and they didn't really understand just how hard it was to walk.
So tell us, teenagers, how many of them? Let people know exactly what your family consisted of.
Okay, so at that time, snapshot, we had a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old, okay, in varying states of education. They were all... I guess a bit sort of excited about going to Spain,
starry-eyed,
and all that sort of stuff. So that was the team that we had there. And interestingly, as time went by, we were being dragged by them. So when we started, it was their, I mean, Jess, the youngest, was having blisters, and I don't want to do this anymore. But within about 2 or 3 days, you get very, very good at it.
Yeah,
you're walking 20 to 30 kilometres a day, and so you get really good at it if you do it every day. And so they got very fast, and we were much slower. So yeah, that was how the relative.
And so it sounded like they started to enjoy it, and also it sounded to me critically that they were old enough to appreciate the trip.
And one of our family sayings is, if things are tough now, we always say, remember, you're a pilgrim. And I don't mean that necessarily in the religious and the old sense of pilgrimage is it's atoning for sins and all that. But it was more that they were able to put up with this incredible discipline of travel each day. So it was wonderful.
And so were you carrying backpacks with gear?
We were, yeah.
Big backpacks? Was that a kind of a physical imposition itself? And did you have to train for this trip?
We did. And on the backpack side, they are ideally 6 kilo backpacks. That's the plan. Mine ended up being 12.
It's extremely difficult to get it down to 6 kilos.
It is. And what helps that is that we weren't camping. So the part of the pilgrimage is that you put yourself on the path and trust the fact that you will get accommodation. So that's one of the quirks of the Camino, is that you don't know where you're going to actually be sleeping that night. So normally a normal holiday is like, let's plan the whatever it is.
Yeah.
Here you have no idea at the end of the day whether you're going to get a bed. And so because of that's the nature of the Camino, they provide what's called albergues, and it's just public accommodation, and it's €2 a night. It was then.
Okay, so you could find it and buy accommodation at each place.
Yeah, and there's a few albergues in each of the villages, and you'd get there. And if it was summer and it was really busy, you probably wouldn't get in sometimes, but we're there in September, which I recommend is the time.
September what year?
It's 2006.
So okay, so quite a long time ago.
Yeah, and interestingly, I'm still talking at author talks. I still do author talks all these years later, and my wife Penny as well. So it's
this trip is sort of the sort of trip that would have a lifelong impact on you, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that people do come to the author talks and they end up going on the Camino, which is lovely. And we don't always get that feedback, but we know that that's happening. So it's great.
Penny's here in the studio. She's nodding a lot and looking at you.
That's always encouraging, isn't it?
Yes. She declined to join the conversation, but I did ask a question earlier. Who did you have to convince the most? Was it Penny about the trip, or was it the kids?
I think, strangely, I don't think there was anyone that had to be convinced all that much. It was a holiday, and it was in somewhere overseas, and it was in the first international holiday, probably the only international holiday. We usually holiday at Dunbogan, which is, I guess, a lead into the other story this morning.
But we will talk about that in a sec. I'm still just fascinated with this trip.
Yeah.
So what did you get out of the trip when you finished? How did you feel after it? Did you feel you'd been on not just a journey, but a journey, if you get my drift?
Absolutely, and without getting too spiritual, it was certainly a revisiting of the fact that my mother had died that year, so there was a lot of that going on. The Camino by nature is a personal experience, even if you go with people. Very soon you'll find they've off in the distance or dragging behind. So you one of the main things of the Camino is that you are with yourself, and you're with yourself for hours and hours. Mm. And in a normal day, you're not really with yourself for hours and hours. And I wouldn't recommend doing that every day, but this is a way to come to terms with some stuff.
It's a meditational process, isn't it? Because walking is something that we, even when you see people walking here, they're walking fast, they're walking for fitness.
Yep.
But back in the day, 50-100 years ago, people walked because they didn't have cars or they didn't even have horses.
Yes.
And so and they were prepared, and it was no imposition or there was no strangeness associated with walking 10 to 15 miles sometimes, or 5 miles to school and back. So
absolutely,
the process of walking, especially if you're coming out of a busy, frenetic 21st century lifestyle, you notice the kind of transition into this meditational sort of
it is a meditational state, and it's one could call it an accidental meditational state. So some people will, you know, in their normal daily life, seek meditation and go into a meditation class and have to break the mood. But here it's literally, it's all around you all the time, and you're faced with yourself. So, it's very interesting.
Okay, now, you're writing another book on Camden Haven Pilot Station because you've holidayed there many years. It's called The First Pilot. Tell us what that's about.
Well, Camden Haven Pilot Station is a bit of a mystery. There's actual two gravestones on the headland. I've been, the same family have been holidaying there for 15-odd years in Dunbogan, not always at the pilot station, but at the moment we're staying at the pilot station, for example. And whenever I'm there, I'm drawn by this story, and the pilot station is a natural history museum anyway, so I just suddenly got interested. And as I delved deeper and talked to the Historical Society, who are very helpful, and the local Camden Haven College, I found there was a mystery, and the local people held this as, I wouldn't call it a secret, but definitely a mystery to them, and there were differing stories. And the grave was of, I'm careful to say pilot, but the first boatman registered in the records is Isaac Williams, and his wife, Frances Williams. Now, she is in one of the graves, On the headland, okay, and next to her are three sailors who died in through drowning in an incident in 1860 with the Prince of Wales, which grounded on Pilot Beach. But what was it's not called, it wasn't called Pilot Beach.
There, history gets lost, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So, so they were buried where they died, and the Historical Society helped sort of explain that. You know, that's what they did. It was almost like an island to get out there. There was, you know, it was a track across the sand dunes. So I don't think they could get to her in time. And her death certificate says stomach inflammation. Local stories vary from appendicitis through to a childbirth. So a great tragedy.
Could have been food poisoning. Could have been dehydration.
Exactly. Mm. But the thing that was even more intriguing was there was an inquest around it. And the inquest, there's no records of the inquest. I looked up what's an inquest about, with talked to the coroner, and they said someone's in custody or care was the thing then. And so that brings up she wasn't a convict. Isaac had an interesting change of names in history. His dad was Isaac Buttress. But as he came into Australia at 15, possibly stowed away, we can't find the record of him arriving or on any of the boats. He changed his name to Williams, and that's mysterious in itself. So mystery abounds. And so the first part of writing the whole thing was to get the chronology right, not just dream up something that was disrespectful, but get the idea. So I've done the first part, the chronology of... is there, and that's based on sort of scientific facts, state archives, local oral history, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You're a man who searches, aren't you?
I am, yes, indeed.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm conscious of the time. It's 25 past nine on ABC Midnight and Coffs Coast Mornings. You have to go because you need to set up for this talk at Port Macquarie Library at 10 o'clock, and if anyone would like to go along and hear what can only be a fascinating chat and talk from Jonathan Drain, give the library a call, 6581 8755. They say you need to RSVP. I'm sure if you just gave them a quick call now, you could probably get an extra chair out. 6581 8755. And before you go, Jonathan.
Yes, yes.
I just want to touch on the fact that you're writing a second autobiographical novel of sorts.
Yeah.
In a sense, I got the impression it might have been in the third person, but it's going to be called The Invisible Man.
Yes, now, The Invisible Man is actually first person biographical. And The Invisible Man is relating to my father, who was a veteran of 9 theatres of battle in the Second World War.
Written in his voice, is that what you mean?
No, in my voice.
In your voice.
And so he's already written a biography of that war experience. And he's one of the rare soldiers to have gone from Tobruk. I've got to be careful because people are very proud of their histories. But he did 9 theatres of battle and across Tobruk and then Kokoda. Most people would have had enough.
Mm.
He was buried alive in Tobruk under Rommel's attack and survived that and then was hoisted out and ended up in Kokoda, for heaven's sake. He didn't know how bad Kokoda was going to be. So that history, he came to our family or created our family out of that history, and there were always two men. There was the bank manager father, the normal father, 1960s, quarter acre block, you know, and then there was this other, the soldier. Mm. And so it talks about the invisible man. Yeah.
Jonathan, we have to leave it there. Would you come back in some time down the track, a few months down the track or something,
yeah,
if you're up here again?
Yep.
To talk, just like a more extended talk about the Way of a Thousand Arrows, about the track, about the trip. Yep. About some of the logistics of it, you would make an excellent armchair traveller for okay. our segment.
Oh, I'd be thrilled to do that. That'd be lovely.
So it's if you want to see Jonathan talking at the library this morning, it's at 10 o'clock. He's speaking mainly on his book, The Way of a Thousand Arrows, that won the Messenger Marketing Prize at the New South Wales Writers' Centre in 2007 at their annual conference. Give the library a call, 6581 8755. Jonathan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Michael.
There we go, author Jonathan Drain speaking on his book, The Way of a Thousand Arrows, an Australian family's journey on foot through the Camino de Santiago.